have somebody who has the questions together.
Some boys already have some questions ready, and then I...
Okay, so fine. So we'll start, whoever it is.
Gabe.
Yes.
Considering that...
I think just before you start, just tell me your name and where you're from, so I have some...
Gabe Heiser from New York.
Okay.
Considering the fact that there's no archaeological evidence like regarding mass revelation until like it's written about thousands of years later, do you think it's possible that the contents of the Torah could have been just legends that were written down at some later point?
I guess the first question, archaeological evidence, if I can give you a marshal, I still remember when X-rays was the only tool, really, imaging tool. And a person could take an X-ray and not find anything wrong because X-rays don't deal well with soft tissue. They don't deal at all with soft tissue. So until you didn't have something like MRI, it was you could take X-ray and it actually says you're perfectly healthy and you had big cancer there, and if the cancer was soft tissue on soft tissue, it would probably distended something, you couldn't tell. The first question about archaeological evidence would be, what archaeological evidence would there be from Haimar Hasina? To ask ourselves, so when people say there's not a lot of archaeological evidence, a lack of archaeological evidence is suspicious when one would expect it. The more, I guess, the real, I don't want to say proof, but the real argument that the revelation about the strength of our Mesoros is a few points. First of all, when did it start? You know, if the legend, somebody had to start it. Whenever you had people in Chumash, in the story of Chumash, that were arguing on Moshe, nobody questioned Har Sinai. Nobody got up in times of Yeshua. In other words, there is no one who casts doubt. When somebody starts something, let's give an example. Mohammed came along and he said, he said, I just had a revelation. And half the Arabs said, well, and half the Arabs said, you're nuts. Mostly the Jews also said he's nuts. But so you have, okay, but somebody came along and he formalized the Torah and said, Rabbi Isai, this is God's truth. Who are the people who are arguing? The Karaites and the Stukim before, A, they always argued Torah Shebal Peh, and B, they didn't even claim they had a Mesorah, they just didn't like the rabbi's ruling. There needed to have been evidence of a conflict. When was it put together? When was it presented? Why is there no written record of Yaakov coming along, John Smith coming along and saying, I found the gold tablets written in ancient Egyptian script? Here it is. Where is the narrative of that? Where are the events that happened? Where's the split in Klal Yisrael between the 50% of people that liked it, 50% of people didn't like it? There never was a doubt until very recently when people started doubting. So the lack of any, there's no narrative other than Har Sinai about Har Sinai, and there's no narrative evidence writings about people saying, you just came along and foisted it on us. Let's say, when did the critical moment come when people accepted as Torah? If it happened at any particular moment, you can rest assured that half the Jews would have been against it. And that's more powerful. It's a very powerful argument. Again, proof, the word proof is a dangerous word because proof means something very different. But the argument, when did this event happen, is really begging for... You know, is begging to it's testing, it's affirming that truth. Yes. You want some? I'm sorry. Yes.
Like, on the topic of Har Sinai.
Yeah.
I remember learning in the Rambam Talmud to Misha.
Yeah.
He says that Moshe received the Torah complete, like from the base to the Lamed. So
yeah.
I'm not really sure. I don't fully understand of how he was able to do that if, you know, most of the Torah didn't happen yet.
So in a sense, it's a machlokus in the Gemara. And the Rambam, if you look at the Rambam carefully, I don't have it in front of me now, but the Rambam says he was given mitzvah upirusha, which means the mitzvahs of the Torah, and both the pasuk that tells you the mitzvah, the sukkah station of Yom, and and the basic halachas. I don't remember that the Rambam says the narrative of events was given before. I don't remember that he says that.
So does that mean Moshe didn't know it? Or?
It's machlok. So the Gemara, if Torah was Megillus didn't know, or Torah Chasuma didn't know. The Gemara asks, what about the Pesuk Mat Yeshua? What the Rambam is being madgish, again, if I remember correctly, is the halacha part of Torah, not the narrative of it.
They said straight, like, from the days from Bereshit to the Lamed in Kol Yisrael.
You know what? I would need to take a look again. I don't want to put words in Rambam, but the Gemara really argues whether each parasha was given as it happened or at the very end. The Goyen says, the famous Goyen that says that he was given the letters of the Torah without the parsing of it, which would make it intelligible the way it is to us. So technically, you had the letters, but they were still at a very seminal stage where it could form other words. And he says the word bedema. It's a famous guy on that Gemara over there. But our kapanim, the basic issue is really in the Gemara, is machlokes in Gemara. Yes? Again, identify yourself, please, and just give me where you're
from. I'm Elliot from Cleveland.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something that... I assume this is something that most people struggle with. I know I struggle with it. But how do you deal with the situation, or how should somebody go about when they know something is true, like they know something to be true, like a halakhic ideal or something true that is stated in the Torah, but up until the point that they learned about that, they had been doing it differently and they hadn't been doing it correctly. So how do you go about like pursuing that truth and like reconciling what your life was beforehand and trying to adjust it to what you know is true?
Going on that path. The first person who had this problem was Avraham Avinu. And Chazal say, he had it worse. He asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what happened to all the years that was over Avodah Zarah? He worked his way towards being a Maimon, was over Avodah Zarah, and the Medrash brings a pasuk in Tehillim, L'chot tal yaldusecha, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give him back, just like dew evaporates and leaves no residue, so to the same here. If a person is born in a setting that did not give him the full knowledge or emotional baggage for keeping Torah mitzvahs, and the person honestly looked for emes and tried to do the right thing and totally found it, my gut feeling is the path that led up to it was also right. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't give us situations that are inherently unfair and judges for it. So if a person had to come from far away, the road itself that you traveled is part of the good that you did. Right? And the truth is, even if you didn't come to religion later, everybody's a teenager at some point in his life. Better earlier than later. But people are teenagers. And people are young kids. And they do stupid things. And do crazy things. Because they're kids. And they're teenagers. And as long as, if this is the way a person is created, and you move towards the right things, then this is your path to doing good, and that's part of the good. Yes? Again, identify yourself with...
Zachary Feinholz from Englewood, New Jersey.
From Englewood, yeah.
Yeah. How come, I don't know, it might be true or not, if when two Tanaim are arguing with each other, if one lived later than the other, should more weight be given to his ruling? Because he would have ruled at a time closer to when they were qualified.
So there are two almost contradictory klalim in Psak. One is, we assume that earlier generations were more closer to the truth than later generations. And that's why no Amora will argue on a Tana, no Rishon will argue on a Moraim, and we don't argue on really early at Tkufis, and so on. On the other hand, within any one Tkufa, there's a klal called halacha kibasroi, that the halacha is like the later one. And the logic for it is, it's a klal in the Gemara really, and it's used in the Rishonim, there's a logic for it. We say the later person heard the argument of the first one, and he probably incorporated it into his thinking process. The earlier person may not have heard the later one. So as a klal, there's a tendency to go with Basroi, but it's not a foolproof. It's not foolproof. It's certainly not ironclad. It's a tendency. It's not an absolute. Yeah. Yeah. So again, just tell me your name and add it.
Andrew.
From
New York.
Yeah.
So we currently live in a time where there is no Beit HaMikdash and there are no Nevi'im. And we say, or it says in the Mishnah Sharam, that like the ultimate purpose of life is to be good to Hashem. So without being able to see Nevi'im and without really being able to see a Beit HaMikdash, how do we know that we're doing it right? And
You know, I'm impressed because I hear, you know, we talk a lot about missing the Beis HaMikdash and we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. And if you press people to the wall about what they miss about the Beis HaMikdash, they're hard pressed. There's an old, like, Jewish tale where somebody's walking by a shul and people were saying kiddush and crying. So he pulls one man out and says, "What are you crying about?" He says, "Beis HaMikdash is destroyed." So he said, "So?" But the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. "So?" So he says, "Oh, the Mishnah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took the taste out of the meat from the time Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and nothing tastes the same. The fruit don't have taste, and the meat don't have taste." So he said, "Well, it says that it went into the bone, so you can crack the bone and eat the marrow." So he says, I have dentures, and they don't crack." He says, "I get it." He says, "You're mourning the loss of your dentures. That's what you're mourning. You put a finger on something and it shows certain sensitivity. That's impressive." In the big picture, there are different types of dveikus. You sometimes have a couple who have a very happy life together, happy meaning externally, a lot of blessings and showered, and it creates a bond. And there's sometimes when you go through a lot of rough tkufas, a lot of problems and issues, and also has a way of bonding people. And you know, and each bond has its own special its unique features. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's the dveikus HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be from someone who has tremendous hatzlach and ruchnius and Torah and so on and so forth, and he's very into it, and that's a tremendous bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And sometimes we can have a bond when we're so far and we miss it. And we realize what we miss, and we live a whole life with it bothering us. That's also a real bond. And if a person loses that, then says, you know, our life is spiritually truncated. We don't have it. That itself is a powerful bond. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose different ways depending on our ma'asim. But that would be the answer where the tevekus comes in.
How do we know that we're connecting to him in the right way? Because like we can't see a Navi who will tell us what to do, and we can't see like the Beit HaMikdash. So how does one know that the path that they're taking is the right path?
So the fact that we don't know, and we need to have a certain constant tefillah and constant bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we're doing the right thing, is what we're supposed to do. You're right. We live with a handicap of not having exact feedback. But if a person does with sincerity and he's mispal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should lead him the right way, and he's boteach that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not mislead him, then he can feel that he went the right way. Yes, you want to ask? Sorry.
Yeah, it's Tom Bourdieu from Arizona, New York. How do you deal with different pronunciations of words within different groups of Judaism, like
Sephardim,
Ashkenazim?
Deal in what sense?
Assuming that one group is right, like, how do you relate to that?
The klal is, since we don't have any way today of reconstructing what's right, then the Gemara says that they found a few different Sefer Torah with different wordings, Meona and so on, and they went Basarov. So there are certain klolim in Halacha that tell us how to act when we don't know. No one today can reconstruct the right pronunciation. The fact that there are so many different groupings of really different pronunciations and sub-pronunciations means that we don't have a clear way back. We need to, it is, and that's why it's important. If you follow the Masorah, you know that you didn't add more mistakes. If you keep changing to what you think is right, hey, you good chance that you'll mess up someplace, and the mess is going to be yours, not someone else's. You know, like this, I say, listen, this is what I was taught. So I don't come to Tainism. The person who taught me Hebrew taught it to me Ashkenazi, Sfaradi, Taimani, Yeki, whatever you want. You know, but if we try to tinker with it ourselves, then we run into a problem. You know, you tinkered with it, but you didn't do a good enough job or whatever. So the klalas, we tend to follow. Whatever we're taught. Rav Yashiv told me once about something similar about Mesoris, that Mesoris is what your immediate teacher taught you. So you go back to that, and that's what. No, the truth is, in modern, even people who are very not integrated into modern Israeli society have picked up, for instance, the normal Litvish pronunciation is Mila'el, not Mila'ra. The normal emphasis on the words is on a prior syllable, not the later syllable. And Lashon Kodesh is not like that. If you would hear an old Litvish person speaking and try to pronunciate the words in Hebrew precisely, he would emphasize the first syllable. Atachoyne lodam das. You know, and a modern Briska, I don't know if that's an oxymoron or not, but somebody, a Briska who is in Livian Stroll, he would say atachoyne lodam das, because he's aware of the need to it. The iron, they've picked up on it and sort of made it. So there is a certain modest effect that the different religions are having on each other. You know, it's interesting, but that, yes?
Is it a problem?
Yeah, can I just... Can I just
sorry. Jason Leonard from the Amazon.
Yeah.
Is it a problem for the Amisorim and Hagim that when all these Jews come to Israel that everything is being like thrown together? Things are...
Do you mean if it's a problem, if it creates problems?
Well, I mean, is it creating problems?
It used to. There were some absurdities. Rabbi Avadia Yosef was at a Bez in Petah Tikva. He was one Sephardi with two Ashkenazi Dayanim. A Sephardi couple came to get divorced, and the Dayanim spelled the get, the names of the get, in Yiddish. The traditional Shulchan Aruch spelling is Yiddish spelling, which is different than Lashon Kodesh. For instance, the ayin is used instead of a segel. He threw up his hands and he said, "No way." He said, "If you want Ashkenazi Ashkenazim is one thing, but for a Sephardi couple to have that, so it did create problems. It created issues. But by and large, poi chazim amatava. Go around and look at people. Everyone seems to be happy with his own nusach, his own davening. Somebody once proposed making a nusach muchad for davening in the army. He said there are 12 different nuschos around. I think it was Zavgorin maybe said, I want to make the nusach, I forgot what it's called, nusach, maybe muchad or something. And I don't remember who was that told him, all you're going to accomplish is there's going to be a 13th nusach. You're not going to get rid of other nuschos. So you'll have a 13th Nusach. So by and large, I think once upon a time there was a dream of having one common Nusach. I think the halachic right thing is to keep your Mesoris, but I think there's a gradual effect between different kehillas, one on another.
Is that bad?
I don't know. Why would it be bad?
Because the minhagim are changing.
Well, a minhag came into being with some sort of change. So there, as long as it's done through a process that's halachically sound and not an attempt to redo the halacha from scratch, it's part of hashgach, I think. Yes?
How do you go...
Yeah, the name is up here.
Okay. Yoni Fried from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
How do you go about the talked about the chokas between with tchilas as to whether we should wear or whether we shouldn't? And even if... let's say it's a suffix, whether it's the right thing, can we still go about to wear it because we feel that it looks cool? Yeah.
So the tchelas machlokes, I guess the harder one to understand is obviously people who don't wear tchelas, because halachically if you wear something which is looks like tchelos but it's not tchelos, it's not worse than white. There's no white doesn't mean white. It doesn't mean it's not tchelos. So what do you have to lose? That's a real. It's a strong argument. The counter argument goes as follows. There's already been at least two in the last 100 years. Two people who came along and were confident and positive about their tchelos, and it pretty much has been disproven that their tchelos is tchelos. So the sense is, unless we're a lot more positive, grasping at straws is not a sound way to do it. You know, there's something about it. Even the tchelos, the version of tchelos, the candidate for tchelos that we have now, many things make sense. Some things don't make sense. They don't fit anymore. So the feeling is it's unsound that we keep sort of catching wind until we don't have something solid. There's also an underlying a Kabbalah kind of mesoris that tchelos won't be misgala to Mashiach. Should that affect halacha? I'm not sure. But the main feeling was, just because somebody has a glint in his eye and says, I found the tchelos absolutely true, it's not, it doesn't fit everything, it doesn't snap into place 100%. It's possibly, it's like, imagine I find a piece, I have a hole in the wall, and I find a piece of plaster, and boom, it fits in exactly. So then I could say, I'm sure this is it. Let's say I find a half a piece that 3/4 of the outline fits. It's likely, but it leaves us some guesswork here. And that's why I think the feeling was it's more people chasing after the wind, and it's wrong to encourage that approach. I gather that that's the feeling that people get.
What about Safik Yashua?
So saying Safik Yashua means when there's solid ground for it. As here, it's an attempt. It's like a mozzarella raya. We 2000, these shells have been around for longest of times. Why didn't anybody figure it out before? Or like, what happened? Is it that tchelos doesn't exist actually? The fact is, what we have doesn't fit everything 100%. It fits many things. The latest tchelos. The latest tchelos is a better candidate than first candidates. It still misses a few things, and a few quite crucial things. It says that the shell looks like the ocean. This candidate doesn't look like that. The one before looked like that. It says something about it's better if it stays alive when you keep bleeding it. Nothing like that in this. That's a Gemara in Shabbos. I got it. It's a Gemara in Shabbos. So there are some issues with it. It's not pashut. So I think the feeling of the poskim is it's another fad. And a fad doesn't go into suffix. Suffix means it's a serious enough, there are enough serious pointers. I would have feel that it's their feeling like that. Yes?
Donnie Steinberg from here. I don't know if this is really an answerable question. But I know for most of us, we come from a background where, I guess, halacha isn't as strict as it's meant to be held, or just a lot of people view halacha as guidelines. How would we be able to respond, to those kind of statements? Not necessarily to prove them wrong, but to support like what you've been exposed to throughout your year in Israel. How would you be able to approach?
Let me say, as a point of curiosity, something that you've piqued my interest is what Dan is saying. Common? Do you feel that way? Do you feel that this background and the tension of wanting to change it is that a common sentiment or not? You want to restate it because I think it's a very important piece that you raised. First, let me give you a practical point. When a person is in your age, you really are very serious about decisions you're making in life, and you make possibly great changes. This is an age when people can have powerful ideals and emotions and make some very, very real changes in life. When you get older and settle down, your emotional metabolism doesn't allow you to make such great changes unless you're not a stable person. For somebody at 18 that changes, makes a sharp change in life, that's not a sign of instability. It's a sign of being 18. And that's the time when a person does those things. When a person is 40 or 50 and he makes great changes, the person is unstable. A person who at the age of 50 puts on, takes off his kippah sugah and puts on a shtreimel and a bekesher, or takes off a bekesher and shtreimel and puts on kippah sugah. It's strange. There was somebody, in-laws of my neighbor, who retired to Eretz Yisrael. So I assume if he retired, it must have been 60. Somebody wore bekesher. Next time I see him, he has a mustache and a kippah sugah. You know, whoa, at 60? At 65? That's a very, very strange, you know, and I you know, it's a strange person. But at this age, it's very... So when you are addressing parents, society you came from, and so on, it's not an easy question to deal with. Because for you right now, things that are not true are not true, and things that are true are very true, and how can you say differently? You are right, but a person who's 20 years older than you, I know it is, but you know, that's the way it is. And you know, it's kind of, emotionally you're coming from two very different places. It makes no sense to accept Torah as a guideline. Either throw the whole thing out the window or keep it. If Hashem didn't give it, then save yourself the you know, so do whatever you feel like doing. If it's a guideline, it's not better than a million other guidelines.
So maybe some would say, like, for, you know, Durban halachos, then those might be guidelines or not as strict.
It would be true, except that all the Rabbanan halachas are d'oraisa. The Rama, it's a parsha in the Torah Shoftim that the Chachamim have the right to be metakein halachas, to keep us from doing averis. So if a person doesn't keep muktzah because he wants to play with something on Shabbos, he's over the Rabbanan. If a person says that Rabbanan's halachas are guidelines, he's over the d'oraisa of Lo Sasser. And the Gemara says, how can we make a mitzvah? We make when the same person who has this attitude about rabbinic guidelines says, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Asher Kitzanu Mitzvoso V'Tzivanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. He's lying. Where does Hashem tell us to keep Chanukah? And then in another month or two, he's going to come along and say, Asher Kitzanu Mitzvoso Amikra Megillah. Where did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell us to read Megillah? You know, listen to what you're saying. So, at a certain age, this is no longer a question because, okay, you know, we say it because we say it. You know, there's no, but it's absolutely sheker. A person needs to define for himself what's right and what's wrong. And if Torah is not a guide, I want to tell you just a story. We're talking about how passionate a person should be about the things that he believes to be right. One of the great lights of the Musa movement was named Rabbi Yosef Horowitz. He was known as the Alter of Navardik. He died during World War I. His yeshivas continued to World War II, and then they were mostly killed out. He was a powerful believer in truth. And the sheet of Navardik was not to budge one inch from absolute truth, no matter what the consequences are. Very, very demanding. And one day, he was a very bright man. Somebody came and knocked on his door and introduced himself as a professor from university and from someplace from a big city. They heard how bright Rabbi Yosef Horowitz was, the alphabetic was. He's come to discuss with him different issues. He wants to sort of lock horns with him. He gets some input and so on. So he said, great, I'm very glad you came. He said, here's the deal. How long do you want to stay here for? He said, a week. He said, fine, we'll spend a week together. If you're right, he said, I leave my talis and tefillin and my yarmulke here, and I go back to university with you. I'm finished. If I'm right, you stay here, and I have a talis and tefillin for you with your yarmulke. This guy says, no, I didn't mean it. I just wanted to discuss. He said, no. He said, life is too short for discussions. Life is there to search for truth. If it's right, then how can you not do it? And if it's wrong, don't let it go over your doorstep. You know, we let ourselves get killed for Torah. We've been living a miserable 2,000 years and sacrificed an awful lot for something that's sort of Benjamin Franklin's guidelines for being healthy, wealthy, and wise. If it's on par with that, then I would strongly advise the person to dump it. It's not worth the price. You know, if you pay a dollar for an old copy of his wisdom, it's worth the price. But the sacrifice that Torah demands from you is not worth it if they're guidelines that are just, you know. Yes. Yeah, someone didn't do you. Anyone that had? You.
I have a question about Masebereshit.
Were you from, what's your name? Sorry?
Elliot from Brooklyn.
Okay, yeah.
Masebereshit. I was thinking about this. If the sun will ingrate on the third day, how is it light on the first day?
Good idea. Good question. We know today that light has nothing to do with the sun. In other words, sun is a source of light. But light inherently, photons, let's call it a form of energy, a certain oscillation. There was light, debris of light, whether it shone on the earth or not, but light was all, the whatever it is that a photon does and however it acts, that's light. The sun is a source of light. And if you take a look at the psukim, the sun and the moon, everything, their main reason for being is to give us a calendar more than to create the light and so on. A certain memshallah and calendars. So light as a bria is way above the sun. It's what photons do. And sunlight is a particular source of light and warmth and magnetic storms and a whole bunch of other things.
But what was the light?
I don't know. I have no idea. Whether it came from a source or just all over or photons were there potentially, I don't know. I mean, you can ask yourself another question. And again, once we talk, my separation is tricky because we're really talking about other things that we don't know and we don't understand. But as a something to puzzle over, ask yourself, why was light the first thing created? If there's no one around, there are no plants who need it for photosynthesis, there's no people need to walk, there are no animals, it's like imagine building a building and starting with the lighting fixtures. Why? It's something to think about. Yes?
I don't remember the exact Rambam, but we were studying whether or not doing magic is halakhically okay, and the Rambam says, no, magic doesn't exist. And
yes.
His opinion was discredited because he was like influenced by the philosophers
right.
of his time. So if we're going to discredit his opinion there for being influenced by the philosophers of his time, why do we take his opinion seriously in other circumstances?
Okay, so let's give it a little bit of a name. The Rambam says it in most places. The Gaon is the one who writes in one place that he was influenced by his philosophy and so on. The Rambam actually in one place says magic has some validity, but very little. But there is something to it. The Rambam in Pirush HaMishnayos, in the beginning of Pirush HaMishnayos, I've done Pirush HaMishnayos, does actually, same as done Pirush HaMishnayos, somebody mentioned before, he does say it. He says that it is true and sometimes it is. Sometimes it's right, but much of the time not. The reason the Rambam was a giant of the giants, possibly the greatest we ever had. The Rambam's halacha and everything else he wrote is clearly built on the Gemara. The source for truth for us is the Gemara. The Rambam is valid because he builds the Gemara and he takes from the Gemara and he sticks to the Gemara. The Rambam in this instance, where the Gemara does seem to feel like magic was a real issue. Where did the Rambam say that it's not? That's what bothered the guy. So he said, why everything else he sticks to the Gemara? He understands it in a certain way. All of this he just completely ignores. The Rambam felt that it's because he was involved with other chachmas that he was misled. And it's the Gaon says that. I don't know if anyone holds like the Gaon. The Gaon is big, the Rambam is big. I don't have a place in that machlokas. But I'm just saying, he said it only based on the fact that this Nekuda, he veered away from the Gemara. Yes?
I hope this question isn't too broad, but to what extent should our belief in Hashem and the Torah and the rabbinic tradition be rooted in intellectual justification and logical and rational proof, or the extent that we can't try to prove like the existence of all those things versus an emotional relationship to God? Now, like we just have an assumed belief in God, and then we try to just strengthen it with our emotions and believing in God.
Let me ask, does anyone have an opinion about what he asked? Does anyone want to offer should we believe? Should we base belief on intellectual proof, mesoras, emotion, connection? Well, yes.
Depends on the person.
Depends on person. Good answer. Not a, yes. Let's hear.
From what I've ever learned, I think belief starts with a basic knowledge that God exists, and a little bit of a leap of faith, and then by doing mitzvah and following Hashem's commandments, emunah comes from that, and by being a practicing Jew, then from doing those actions, they bring you closer to Hashem, and then real belief stems from that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. In terms of machloket, I'd like to go back to who's the one that said it depends on the person. So the truth is as follows. Let's take something simple. When a cop is trying to determine who killed somebody, how does he do it? Well, the first thing is he asks himself, who would have wanted to kill him? You know, if it looks like a murder that was planned, somebody must have wanted to kill him. Who are the people that could have wanted to kill him? He looks around at clues that he finds. He gets informers to tell him, and then he can track phones. He can do a lot of things, and then when he questions somebody, he uses some intuitive sense about is the person lying or not. And if he finds a video, he knows for sure who killed him. But when we have many ways, no one way is safe and sound to prove it. Because when a person decides a woman that he would like to marry, or a woman decides on a man, how do you decide it? Based on what? Well, there's a whole bunch of things. What's the person's background? And what do I find out about the person? I've spent time with the person dating. What's that like? What do we want in the future? There are many different pieces. A really good emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu includes all of those pieces. That's the truth. But for different people, different pieces are going to be the significant one. For some people, the intellectual approach is going to be the solid base, and doing the mitzvahs will help, and the emotions will help, and so on. For some people, it's that feeling of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's really the cornerstone. And also the fact that it makes sense and we have proofs and so on. So I think the real answer is all the pieces are necessary, because if you walk into a place that it makes sense, but there's something of the feel of the people is weird, you're not going to become part of it. And if you like people, but what they're saying is utter nonsense, you're not going to agree with it also. So you need to have all the pieces in place, but you also need, each person has the main piece, the centerpiece of himself. Yes?
In the Sifrei Neviim and Tuvim, how, I guess for lack of a better term, religious were the general population of Jews?
I think each Tkufa was different. They were different in terms of what their problems were. They're different in terms of if you learn Tanakh, there were many of them, but Azara. Was it a majority or just too big of a group to ignore? Not clear. How many years in each one?
Yes. The times of the Avodah Zarah, were they keeping Tuman Tahara? Like throughout that time, were they careful about Lashon Hara? They were much closer to revelation than we are.
Correct. But they also had a much stronger Yetzer Hara. So, you know, Avodah Zarah was very powerful. And we don't understand it because we have to translate our taiva. Imagine if our taiva would be Avodah Zarah. It would be very tough. It wouldn't be easy. So the people in those days, I think, had a very strong taiva Avodah Zarah. And they probably kept the other things. It's just like in different kufis, different things were problematic. The Rambam, if you want to take, the Rambam has a letter in Igris where he writes that the vast majority of the women in Egypt, where he was living, in his days in Egypt, were not going to the mikveh. And they would sprinkle water, like the Karaites said, you know, like make zrika, like, because it says the pasuk, you know, that it was rak lechem mayim tahorim and so on. And he came out with a big cherem, in case charam didn't start today. The Rambam had a cherem that any woman who doesn't go to the mikveh, the husband could divorce her without giving a ksuba and so on and so forth. Very, very powerful. That seemed to have been the problem. You know, keeping Shabbos, Shomer Shabbos. When I was growing up, it still was a very big issue. Jobs demanded that you be there. Most jobs demanded Shabbos. Owning a store, your best day of business was Shabbos. It was a very, very difficult day to hurry. Today, being Shomer Shabbos is much easier. Yes, we have an iPod that we have to keep servicing on Shabbos. You know, the iPod demands to be fed on Shabbos. But people didn't have a livelihood if they didn't work on Shabbos. You know, your best business day was Shabbos. So each generation has their Yetzirah. What can you do? That's the reality of it. Yes?
Just to follow up my last question, what should the role of the yeshiva be for kids coming, let's say, for a year or 2 years in Israel? How should they approach, you know, trying to teach kids, you know, what the proper mahalach is for, you know, establishing Emunah and Hashem? There are some yeshivas that focus on justifying it intellectually, and there are those who just take belief in God as a given, an assumption, and try to build on that. So, should that be specific to kids, and like yeshivas should just try?
Okay. There are two parts to your question. What should a yeshiva, like, you know, like this, a yeshiva that's a 2-year program, you know, 1 to 3 year program. So, the first thing I would say is, the famous line about teaching a person to fish rather than giving him fish? What a yeshiva is supposed to accomplish, and I've seen, like, but a few talmidim I've seen, I think the yeshiva does go far in accomplishing it, is to help them realize that you need to work a whole life on Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit is not something passive. If it's not active, it dies. It peters out. If you're not actively pursuing it, it's not easy later on, but if you're not actively pursuing it, you lose it. It's like hot water. No matter how hot it is to start with, if you don't keep it hot, it becomes cool. That's a law of physics. There's no, you know, heat travels to cold. It doesn't, nothing heats up in its own. You have to keep it hot or you have to keep boiling it. What? So yeshiva needs to do that. I also think a yeshiva is made for talmidim. And you need always to adjust. What are the needs of this talmidim? Is it ruach? Is that going to stoke emunah? Is it intellectual discussions? Is it active learning, animated learning? It's probably all of them, but the dosage, a good rebbe / yeshiva will adjust the dosage to fit the talmidim. Rav Volbe, Zichrono Livracha, was a mashgiach, in a big mashgiach in Eretz Yisrael. There, and he was from the last big Bali Musa that we had. You know what, Ali? Sure, I'm sure you've heard of Rav Volbe. He was in, you heard of him because I gave a shir in Ali Shur in yeshiva in the high school. Rav Volbe was, he wasn't a mashkir in the mir, the list, a few decades of his life, but he said a shmuz every other week. He was like a quasi mashkir. So he once came in to my father. He used to come to my father was a yeshiva emir. He used to come to him twice a year to visit Yantif to pay a kabbal play rabbi type call. So I was there a few times, and once he was talking to him and he said, it used to be in Europe that the job of a mashkiach was to sand you down. You came in rough and the mashkiach would start chipping pieces off you. You think that you're a big maspit? You're not a big maspit. You're an attention grabber. You think that you're a big davener? You're busy shepping nachas from how people are looking at your Shmoneh Esrei, and so on. It used to be in Europe, but every did the mashgiach told you were wrong. Like if you said thank you, mashgiach said, what's this thank you about? If you didn't say thank you, where's the thank you? A mashgiach was there to always criticize, to shine you, you know, to buff you, to shine you, and so on. He said, today, Rav Volbe said, there's a new word now, dictionary. It's called depressed. If a mashgiach looks at a bacha, he's already depressed. He's in the blues, and he disappears in shiva week. He said, today, the job of mashgiach is to prop up a bacha that he shouldn't be depressed. He should always feel good about himself. And so he said it a little bit sarcastically, but he said it with the realization today you can't just say blindly what was yesterday I'm doing today. Bachem, in Europe, people could take knocks and people grew from it and people anticipated it. Today, people need a lot of bolstering of their self-confidence. So you need to do that. You know, so yeshiva should be doing whatever the bachem need. It's really what a yeshiva should do. Yes?
First of all, I'd like to come to answer all the questions.
You know, I'd rather say the word discuss. I don't think there are answers to these questions. I think there are beginning of answers, but I would hope that you think and either think past my answer, develop the answer, use that as a guideline. You know, these are questions, I mean, you're asking questions that are real life questions, and it's a development of your thoughts. So I would, you know, I will hope that I'm, at best, I hope I'm a catalyst.
How would, I don't know if this is common, hopefully not, but how would one go about dealing with a community rav who holds many like ranking positions within the community, who is a known Talmud Chacham, but people don't necessarily agree with his, the way he interacts with members of the community? On a personal level.
It's a real problem. It's a problem, you know, it's a dilemma. And let me explain what the dilemma is. A rav of a community should be the leader of the community. His word and his deed should set the standard, the example, and people should follow, even if they disagree with what he paskin or whatever it is, they should follow. A, because they should suspect that maybe they're wrong, and B, because of that. What do you do if the rav is a person who's not a good person? Unfortunately, Rabbanim are chosen by communities. Some communities are very astute in picking a leader that deserves the title Rav. It's not only based on knowing Gemara or Halacha, it should be based on a person that has a darga of a certain Shlemus. If you don't, there's a real issue there. And a community is best to try to find someone that they can look up to as a person. It's sad. People, communities, you know, a rav is as good as the community that chose him many times. And if the community had a certain amount of sincerity and wisdom, they choose people that are of stature. He can speak a little better, he can speak a little worse, but there's a person there that you respect and his wisdom. If you choose sometimes somebody just because he's nice, has a cute smile, and he's, you know, and he's a darling, and then he's, as time goes on, you realize he's not a big Talmud Chacham, or his midos are really off. I don't know. It's a real problem. You know, it's time to look for a different community. That's the truth. I'm serious. If you really feel that way, and it's you know, the person that's clearly a deeply faulty character. I don't know.
If you don't have a problem with the way he is, but you're talking to other people who do, well, how would you respond to the situation?
You know, you can try. A lot of times there's an issue with communication. A lot of times it's possible to bridge the gap by helping the Rav understand what it is that irritates people. Sometimes it's a small thing. Sometimes it's something that's just a question of how to convey the message. You know, I don't know. These are really tough situations. Yes. Was somebody behind you? Someone else wanted to ask you? Or yeah. Okay.
In your opinion, what is the proper halachic approach to the situation going on with Palestinians and Arabs demanding more land from Israel? Like, to what extent should we be willing to give up land from a halachic perspective?
So I don't know what the yeshiva's official, what this yeshiva's official halachic stance, if it has any. I don't know. I can map out two different approaches, and therefore. And what I personally think shouldn't be, I don't want to interject personally, but I can just give you, there are people, and I guess this would be more where I come from, that their attitude towards Eretz Yisrael is that it's a tremendous mitzvah to live here, but the overriding factor is pikuach nefesh. what is the pikuach nefesh? I'm not sure if a rav would be the right one to decide. There's an argument to be made that giving up the land puts us in danger. There's an argument to be made that keeping the status quo puts us in a greater danger. And I think reasonable people can see it both ways. So the person who could make that, I don't know who's the professional. Like, who's the equivalent of a doctor for medical issues in an issue like this? I don't know. I've read many wise, you know, I remember when Kissinger, who was a brilliant, brilliant statesman, made peace in Vietnam and was like, he might even won a Nobel Prize for it. And he was, I mean, he was always full of himself at that time. I mean, he couldn't, the world wasn't big enough for him. Vietnam disappeared a few years later. You know, 2 or 3 years later, it was off the map. But this is, Kissinger was supposed to be a brilliant statesman. His books are, you read his books, they're fantastic. Nonsense. On the other hand, I think people need to realize there's a lot of bluster in saying, here, we'll hold on to it. You're dependent. And you're keeping a situation going that's becoming a greater pressure cooker, a greater pressure cooker. I don't know, certainly don't have any moves there, but my halachic position would be there. There are rabbanim, mostly, obviously much more in Dati Lumi camp, who have a position that Eretz Yisrael is something, obviously, something you need to be most nefesh for, of Yarek Vayavu stature. Like, and why is that mentioned? Halacha, they have different reasons. In their mind, you can't give up any of it. And for reasons that go beyond, it's a con or not. So there are basically three approaches. One is make the wisest compromise possible that has a chance of bringing some peace. Two, giving up anything is a great sakana, and therefore we need to hold on to it, suffer a little bit here or there, because that's the best option in terms of pikuach nefesh. And then there's a shita that at Yisrael trumps pikuach nefesh as well. Different nuschos. I identify with the first type person. So that's where we'll come from. And I also have an admission to make that I'm from the very first group that believes that they have to make some compromise because it's untenable the way it is. I don't feel right. It's like my going to the Nusfar community and telling them how wonderful the Hashkenaz is. Whatever, I don't know if the yeshiva has a sheet as a yeshiva or wherever you come from, but at least I can outline the different positions in a way that makes sense. Yes?
A little bit of a similar question.
Let me see, you didn't ask before, did you?
No.
So we actually got some new Panam Hadashas. What's it?
Daniel Allen from Edison, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Can you outline, or as you said, map out the idea that Israel should not be state till Mashiach comes?
Should that be state till Mashiach comes?
I mean, I know that's an opinion. I just, yeah.
So, okay. So let's move further right, and we'll map out. The anti-Zionist or a-Zionist understanding. And again, I have no ability or right to impose personal position, but I think it's important to understand the different shittas. The people who were against the Zionists, you had the groups like Satmar and so on, the Hungarian Hasidim that were aligned with Satmar, that felt that any attempt to make a state is wrong, it's usher, we're gullus, we have to be gullus, it's based on Mark Subis, Shalosh Shavuos, and so on and so forth. That was their position. That it's wrong to try and do anything there. The position of, I guess, Mor Aguda, and again, this is where I'm personally aligned with, this is my Rebbe and so on, was different. They were against Zionism, they did not have a problem per se of us creating a state before Mashiach comes. Ramesh, I think someplace wrote, it's an agarata, and we don't pass like that. There's no psak like that. They had a different issue. It's a more subtle issue, but I think it's a much deeper issue. Zionism was not about going to Israel and making a state and defending yourself in an army. Zionism was a much deeper movement, and it's important to know the history a little bit. When the emancipation came and the world changed in the 1700s, and then into the 1800s, depending, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Jews, the first thing they did was many Jews wanted to assimilate. They were sick and tired of being third-rate citizens. I'll use a word, they were the niggers of Europe. They were the dregs. They were trampled in every possible. The freedom to go and become like everybody else, assimilation became an attraction. The goyim turned around and drew back a lot of their freedoms, and most Jews realized it's not going to work. The goyim will not accept us as goyim. So, but they wanted out. So a whole bunch of movements developed. There was communism that felt that the problem was that if we change the world and make it a better place and everybody's equal and so on, then anti-Semitism will disappear and so on. There were a group of people that said no. The reason why we're garbage and trash is because we're not a nation. It's like a homeless person. The word homeless and person is an oxymoron. Anyone who's homeless, we don't look at as a person. You know, we look with contempt at someone who sleeps in the park bench and so on. So their attitude, and if you read Herzl, is the Jewish nation needs to be a nation. It's a people who have a country with the structure of a state. Religion, up to every person. We have a tradition, it's lovely. You don't like it, it's fine. But it was a redefining of the nation. We're a nation, is a French people are Catholic. But France could be, the French people can be envisioned as a people without Catholicism. It doesn't, that's not what makes them into a people. You know, Americans like baseball. But you can't say that that's the core of it. It's a thing. So the Zionism tried to redefine Judaism as a peoplehood, a nationhood, like Bulgaria and like everything else, and religion being part of it. The religious Zionists said, listen, that's their way of expressing that, but down deep they're Jewish, we'll align with it, and so on and so forth. So those were the two oppositions, just to recap. One was the idea that until Mashiach comes, we're not allowed to do anything. One was that the Zionist movement itself is a very powerful movement that's off the track, and we can't interact with it in a meaningful way. So those are the other. Yes?
But looking from the, I guess, as you said, the good perspective, what's specifically wrong with people identifying as a nation if they otherwise would assimilate and have nothing?
Because you're only pushing the assimilation and adjuration, and also you're creating a core mistruth. We became Hayoyim Azeh Niyesu La'am. Klal Yisrael is the people that forge a covenant with God. Anything else, you know, my father came from Lithuania, my mother from Poland, my wife from Israel. Jews have nothing in common except for the bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forged a bris with us. That's what we are. Take that away. We're not. We stole somebody's land. That's what Rashi says. Our right to Eretz Yisrael is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, come in. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us, your right for the land is Im Shamoah Tishmu. It's you know, our first Rashi says that the reason why you start with Bereishis is to justify Israel. We have a problem. We write very clearly, we kicked out a lot of people to take over Israel. And it's wrong. Except that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the landlord, and they were tenants. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you have a right to live there only as long as you keep the mitzvahs. So to redefine our peoplehood in a way that's not emes is a distortion, and that's why they were against it in a fundamental way.
In the process of, I guess, redefining it like that, if with a full emunah in Hashem, us taking over the land again and all this happening would be God's will.
Correct. It's hard to put. Listen, you have so many people feeling so many different things and so on. It's hard to say exactly this and this, but I'm saying the general process was that. And let me give you another thing also. The argument about at least it keeps us from assimilating, it's a problematic argument. It's true, but is the conservative or reform movement, have they helped a little bit keeping people assimilating? Possibly. The Rambam writes, Christianity and Islam have kept people from worshiping real Avodah Zarah. Does that mean we should give to Catholic and Islam charities? I doubt it. I had strong doubts the Rambam had a pushka for the local mosque in his living room, unless the local mosque forced him to have one. So we can recognize. I do think Eretz Yisrael has, whether people wanted it or not, Israel has had a tremendous role in helping bring people back, in helping keep people. Today, I think for most Jews, it's Israel and the Shoah is the only thing that is their identity. So there is something. Birthright attracts many people because somehow they feel Israel talks to them. I think if you look at it in reality, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha certainly has meant it to be a point of bringing people in. What we should do about it, I think we need to focus on the Torah Mitzvah aspect of it. Yes, maybe another question too, and then we'll. Yes. What's your name again?
Benjamin Kakian from Long Island. This is kind of like something you said before, whenever you talked about how like the rabbis were able to tell people that they should make brachot and such things like that. But if it says in the Torah, in the Ten Commandments, that you shouldn't say God's name in vain, how did the rabbis know they were allowed to let everyone start making brachot with Hashem's name?
I think, like you said, the word "in vain" means there are occasions when we should use it and occasions we shouldn't. Praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a core mission, and that's why the Chachamim, who knew how to make a proper bracha, had the right to do it and the obligation to do it. Maybe another question too, and then maybe some new faces. Or says Ponim Chadash is Marav Simcha. Benji is not a new face, but for the question answer. Yeah.
Are there parts of Tanakh that we can translate allegorically?
The answer is, depending on the inyan, you might have to translate allegorically. And those inyanim that deal with visions and things of that nature, they certainly are allegories. The parts that deal with historical fact, you're basically destroying the nemanis of it. It depends on the context of the pasuk.
Specifically, Parshas Vayera, beginning of Parshas Vayera, when the three Malachim came to Amram.
Okay, that's the famous Rambam he's referring to, that the Rambam and Ramban argue about it. The Rambam is taking it allegorically only. He's not taking it allegorically. The Rambam sheet is all over, that angels and dreams go together. Angels come in dreams, and anything that came to you in a dream was an angel. And therefore, by definition, if somebody spoke to a malach, it had to be in a cholam. So the word allegory is not right quite. It's the right way to translate a malach is through a dream. Yes?
Max Holland from Woodmere, New York. So if that's the case, how do you explain the seeming contradictions between the first paragraph of Bereishis and the second paragraph of Bereishis? Meaning, how it says that in the first parag that man and female were created at the same time, and then in the second parag says that female was created after as an extension of man almost, or that...
Let me give you a muscle. And does anyone know... You ever see... I mean, it's... I'm well, not going to say anymore, because they have the 3D television or movies. How do they work? Does anyone know how they work? Does anybody know how they work? Two pictures that
same time.
They're not. It's. There's more than that. Two pictures that
they're on the same screen.
Overlap.
No, it's two pictures that are slightly different. In other words, how does your mind form a 3D image? It works like this. My right eye and my left eye don't see exactly the same thing. Obviously, they're coming from different angles. The mind sits and says to itself, why am I getting two different pictures? So it must be that it's deep, and therefore it translates it into depth. So I don't know if you've ever seen, when we were kids, that these little kaleidoscope things. I don't think, you know, when you look at that, you could see 3D images because it worked. You saw one image here, and the mind puts it together. That's why people who have only one eye, they have trouble gauging depth. I mean, if you ever seen, there's sometimes steps where you can't tell if a step's or not because the way it's positioned, it's very hard to, and it gets you very annoyed. You're not sure if there's a white line, it's a real step, and so on. That's how the mind sees 3 meters. There's something, one of the 13 meters is Shneik Suvim HaMakrishim Zeser, Natshiyob HaKosash Yechriyah. When we have a contradiction of two parashas, that tells us we need to understand what must be what must be the truth, which in one way looks this way, one way looks the other way. So if I tell you that Reuven is a nice person, and someone else tells me he is a difficult person, one way of reconciling is that one of us is lying. The right way of reconciling is this person knows him in business, this person knows him on the golf course. Sometimes a guy is nice in business and mean on the golf course, sometimes vice versa, which is more important. But that's so when I have two parshas like that, that's where Chazal darshan. Chazal say, I have one pasuk like this, one pasuk like this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him from here, and spoke to him from here. Which is it? There must be an answer that fits both. In case, if you know it, CAT scan works like that. A CAT scan has an X-ray coming from a lot of different angles, and the computer says, how come I'm getting these different images? It must be that the real thing looks like this, and that's why from this angle, so this angle, so on and so forth. So two psukim that contradict each other, Chazal will usually fill in for us what's the piece that's missing. Yes?
What's
your name? Sorry?
David Goodenacher from Queens.
Yeah.
It's not really a question that I wanted to ask much, but I know that other people wanted it asked. So recently in America, there's a lot of controversy over a topic about Orthodox schools letting girls with on spilling.
Right.
Do you have an opinion or anything to say about that?
It's one of these... let me say to you the area and why, what's important, what's about the issue. Halachically, it's hard to find a problem with it. They can do mitzvahs that are zman grama, even though they're not chayef. The real issue is as follows. Two problems. One is, there's a reason, there must be a reason why for 1,000 years women bench a lul v'nesrig and if they're not chayev to the hair shayfer and everybody seems to fine with it, they never wore talis in tefillin. Why not? It's like the same like chelus. The mesoris is very powerful, and to change it on a whim without a really good reason to make extreme changes, it's a motzer vel v'raya. We need to ask ourselves why or what. Secondly, where's it coming from? You know, women are chayev to dress according to halacha. And, there's room to be machmir, there's room to keep halacha, and there's room to cut corners, literally and figuratively. Why is it that the same person who is looking for the greatest cooler possible, pachas migimel, lavud, all sorts of different... That's in Arab when you have different spaces. And as long as the three fachim between them, it's considered closed, and so on. It's not considered closed, it's considered closed. The person has no problems with. All of a sudden, and tefillin is the mitzvah they're running for. So where's it coming from? The answer is because since culturally, women's gender egalitarianism is a big thing. So somebody woke up and said, "We're demanding to be equal in college and dorms and everything else, but in shul we're not. So let's do the same." It's not coming; it's coming from someplace other than the right place, and it's a sense. You can't accuse any one person because people will be very annoyed. They'll say, "What are you talking about? You can't see my heart. You don't know." But if I need to stand back and ask myself, here are women that do very little mitzvahs. They cut corners in every way possible. And all of a sudden, it's like what I find amazing is the same schools where the girls insist that they need to learn Gemara, the boys are nowhere to be found during Gemara. It's like the same schools that have a track record where Gemara is the university most boring subject, and nobody wants to take Gemara, the girls are thrilled and they want Gemara. is it not coming from something other than a desire to follow Yiddishkeit? And I think that's where the issue lies. Yes?
Just point on that, just a question. A man can go to the Kotel and Chavanix will run at him with tefillin to beg him to put tefillin on.
Right.
So how would you respond to a woman, if you would give that answer to them, who's somebody who's passionate about this, they would say to you, what do you mean, like a guy can just go do that, why can't I go do that? Once you're breaking the bounds, there's no difference. So, like, yeah, guys also looking for kulas in other areas.
I'll say,
so
for a man after wear tefillin, he's being over, it's a, the Gemara calls it, kakafta loyman after tefillin is a terrible avera. So a man, I'm helping him do what he must do. For a woman, she has her mitzvahs, her world, raising children, having children. But, you know, every moment that a woman gives her child is holy, it's precious. And we need to find our fulfillment in the mitzvahs that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, not what we choose. And, you know, that's a man putting on tefillin is very chamar. And by the way, that same school, I'm sure there are plenty of boys that on an off day don't particularly put on tefillin. You know, it's the reality of it. Yes?
So this is kind of touching upon another question I had. I've heard people, when they talk about non-Jews, refer to them not necessarily like terribly, but like you know, God, I'm not going to like let a guy clean my house. If it's not. Like something like that I've heard specifically in like kind of grandparents and people like that. And so, do you think it's just like a Western influence that's, it's a bad Western influence that people think equality is better and things like that? God is not necessarily like, oh, he's just a guy, like he's a person too.
The real Torah Hashkafa is that every single person is created with Tzlam Elokim. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to destroy stone, HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want to destroy Mitzrayim, that we're going to bring Mashiach in order to bring Geula to the world as a whole, that every human being is precious, and so on. Our relationship with the Goyim in Europe was horrible. And I don't think it was our fault. I don't know, we might have done things wrong, but I think, you know, I think everybody realizes where it was. So that was an attitude. Having said that, so there's something to be said about the attitude of Menschlichkeit, of looking at someone, Kim, respecting everyone, and so on. But I think you also have to bear in mind, you don't want to break down cultural barriers. You want that your interaction with non-Jews should be respectful, should be caring, sensitive. But Havdalah between Klal Yisrael and Klal Yisrael is an extremely important, it's extremely important value in Halacha. And for us to engage in the lowest common denominator, they drink beer, we drink beer. They sit in games, we sit in games. They sit in movies, we sit in movies. You don't want to break the barriers down, but you want to fulfill your real obligation to treat everybody at Salmo Tekir. Yes?
David Gold from Lawrence, New York.
Yeah.
The Rambam mentions in Hilchos Talmud Torah how much one should learn in a day and how much one should work.
Right.
And if I recall correctly, he says one should work only 3 hours in a day.
Right.
So how would that apply nowadays?
Well, if you sit in Kaili, you're not working 3 hours a day usually. The things like this. You have to translate the Rambam. What the Rambam is saying is, I say melachtecha, you know, terasa kva melachtecha, right? That a person should plan his day that he should be mostly learning of. Is it possible today to do that or not? Let me tell you, let me share something with you. By us in Yeshiva, Yeshiva is physically located in the Washington community. It's like in the center. The Washington community is by and large, almost everybody's professional. And there's a lot of interaction. Our Talmidim usually end up in some of the professions in Washington. One of our Talmidim, who's a brilliant law student, really brilliant, really, really somebody who did phenomenally well, and had a choice, an agonizing choice to make, whether or not to go into a private law or government law. The difference is a few hundred thousand dollars a year. A private job, this person could have gotten well over 500. After a year or two, he would have been probably doing $600,000 a year. As a government, he'll top at 150. It's not going to go further than that. The difference, however, is if he works in a private law firm, he has no day, no night. He's meshubin. He's, you know, Shabbos he has off, but that's it. In the government, it's very flexible. Government is a great employer. They believe in davening with a minyan. They believe in learning kaveitim, and the hours in the government are great. And this person had to struggle with it, and it wasn't easy. And he chose to go to government. And you know, he lives very, very frugally. But in the morning, as I said before, davening. At night, he says a shir. Shabbos is a shir. You know, and that's a modern day translation of the Rambam. We don't have. There's no such. There are no jobs today for 3 hours that will pay you a salary to live on. But we do have choices to make, and a person knows even business. A person can expand to a degree where he has no life left over, or he can, you know, he can have a business and he's very good at it, and there's a lot of potential. But he's reining it in because I want to have a ruchnistika talk to myself. That's the challenge. That's how we translate it today's level. Okay, maybe one more question, that's it. Yes?
So, myself and my roommate very much enjoy reading, you know, literature or historical novels or things of that sort. What do you think that the Torah approach or the learning approach to that would be? Like, how much should one read? Should one read at all?
If a person, there is value in many things. I also like to read a lot. It's something that, you know, but you need to be master of yourself. You can't read to a degree that it's taking your head out of learning, that you can't focus anymore on learning. You can't, you need to sit down and ask yourself, what's an appropriate amount for me to read? People who enjoy that much usually need some of it in order to relax. But they need to shift gears, and you have to be honest with yourself. What amount will optimize your day and your week and balance it in a way? When you're reading also, if you're reading things, many of the things you're reading you get into, you have to ask yourself, whose shoes am I in? In other words, if you read a novel, I'm talking about a good novel, with real value, not trash. But you're in somebody's shoes. It has an effect on you. Is this right? Is this not right? Do I want to go there or not? And I think if you're master of it, then I think it's positive or necessary at the least, because that's who you are. But you need to be able to control yourself and say, this is something I ought not read. This is something that maybe I can read, but it just gets me so into it, I can't, when I'm learning, I'm daydreaming about it, and I need to cut back on it. This is something that I can read and ought to read, it's something of value, and it gives me some kind of breather. I think being able to be an honest master over yourself is the key. It's true about anything, like playing ball, anything. If a person can make decisions, stick to them, and understand that there's room for almost everything. Okay, I very enjoyed being with you.